We were talking about interpretations of quantum mechanics, and yesterday I talked about de Broglie-Bohm theory, spontaneous collapse theories. I'm not going to have time to talk about, but I have put the slide all my slides on spontaneous collapse theories in last lecture slides, so you can have a look at them. Generally, I try to give all the main interpretations a fair hearing, but I do have to say that if spontaneous collapse theories are true, I will eat my hat. Because I consider them the least plausible of the candidates here. So the last two interpretations we're going to talk about, they're kind of the fun ones because they're the ones which end you up having kind of a really sort of bizarre ontology and having to think through what the implications of that are. So today we'll talk about the Everett many worlds interpretation. So the starting point for that is, well, let's go back and list the axioms of quantum mechanics, right? I mean, the Everett in many worlds interpretation is kind of the church of the larger Hilbert space on steroids, right? So we have these dynamical axioms, and we want to think of this as like just an equation of motion for some object specifying a dynamical theory, right? And then we have these things down here, and who ordered all of this nonsense down here, right, basically? Okay, so we have a sensible deterministic theory where you have some kind of state evolving in time, and then we have these sort of seemingly arbitrary measurement postulates put on top of it. The Everett interpretation was first proposed by Hugh Everett in 1957. Took a while for it to gain any kind of traction. It wasn't really until the 1980s or so that people started paying attention. And the community that first started paying attention to this was actually quantum gravity, quantum cosmology, because there you really have a situation where you're trying to describe the entire universe quantum mechanically, right? So there's no system outside the universe. So they saw this approach. People like DeWitt saw this approach and they thought, oh, well, here's an approach where I don't need to divide the universe into a system and a quantum system and a classical system. So this will be great. So they started being taken seriously then. It has a fair amount of traction in the quantum computing community as well, but obviously not universally agreed upon. Okay, so the approach that I'm going to describe here is mostly based, particularly the account of probability is mostly based on what I'm calling Oxford Everettianism. If you go to the philosophy of physics department in Oxford, you'll find that there's something very strange in the water at Oxford. All the people in that department believe in the Everett interpretation, so that's one of the centers of study of this stuff. And in particular, David Wallace did his PhD on this subject, and this book here is basically a development of his PhD thesis. It's probably the most complete account of Everett that you can find still. I'm going to combine that with Zurek's ideas on decoherence. We talked a bit about that a couple of lectures ago. But the basic idea here is that we're going to view the dynamical axioms as unproblematic. So the quantum state, this describes some ontological physical state evolving in time, that stuff. The entire universe obeys those rules. Okay? Now, if we were thinking about the orthodox interpretation, then we come to the measurement problem, and it comes into conflict with the measurement axioms, right? You can't have both. You can't describe a measurement both by unitary evolution and by the measurement axioms at the same time. So Everett did something very simple. He proposed that we simply throw away the measurement axioms, and we have to derive them as somehow effective emergent rules that an observer who lives in this kind of universe would end up using. So basically, there you go. This is the Everett interpretation. That's it. Okay, end of lecture. But of course, the big problem with this is how are we going to get out the appearances of what we see, what the measurement outcomes that we see in the classical world that we see out of this kind of formalism. Okay, so this is the basic idea. right? So the primitive ontology that Everett proposes, unlike in De Broglie-Bohm, the primitive ontology is supposed to correspond to the kinds of things we see, particle positions, right? This doesn't directly correspond to our everyday experience, so we have to derive our everyday experience as somehow emergent from the quantum state evolution. So when you look at a state like this, where a Stern Gerlach measurement is done inside Schrödinger's cat's box and it corresponds to either the cat being alive or dead, right? We know that we only experience something that is described like something like this or something that's described by something like that, right? We don't ever see something that corresponds to this superposition. So basically, if this is nonetheless the ontology and we admit that what we see is just one of these things or the other things, there's nothing in the actual ontology of the theory that picks one of those out as being the real one and the other one as not being the real one, right? Remember, we're not having any ontology other than a unitarily evolving quantum state. So if our world of experience exists, so we see either this thing or that thing, and the ontology is just the quantum state, it implies that there are many worlds, right? So the important thing here is that the many worlds in Everett are supposed to be derived as a consequence of the ontology, not posited, right? So the argument basically is, look, my experience corresponds to something like this, but nonetheless, I know that the ontology of the universe is just this thing, right? So if this corresponds to some classical world of experience, then this must also correspond to some classical world of experience because there's nothing that really distinguishes the two. So Everett's initial idea was to define the idea of relative states, right? So the idea is that relative to spin up, the cat is alive, relative to spin down, the cat is dead, okay? But both are equally real. That's the basic idea. So the next thing I'm going to say is a little bit of an aside. It's kind of a cute Everettian argument, but I don't think it's all that important. But suppose we model an observer as a quantum system. How do we know that observers see definite outcomes in the measurement? Okay, so quantum state evolution says this kind of thing happens. Okay, there's a superposition. How do I know that that corresponds to an observer having seen something definite? So David Deutsch had a nice answer to this, just ask the observer, right? So what I'll do is I'll pass you a blank piece of paper, right? You're inside a box, right? You're an isolated system, but I'm gonna pass you a blank piece of paper into this box onto which you should write yes if you saw a definite outcome and no otherwise, right? Now, if I'm an Everettian, this is described by a unitary interaction, and we would think that, okay, well, if this is your state in the box and I pass you the blank sheet, then the unitary interaction should result in you writing yes on the paper. And if you're in this state, that's definitely a definite outcome state, you should write yes on the paper, okay? But then by the linearity of the evolution, if I apply the same evolution to this, you will also write yes on this sheet of paper, right? Who likes that argument, by the way? You like that argument? Okay, let me give you the counter argument. I could equally well say, okay, it's clear that if you're in this state, it's clear that this is not a state of definite, of observing a definite outcome. So I could instead posit that this should go to all that stuff. No. It's clearly that's not a state of definite. And then I do the same thing with the minus sign here. Whatever, no. And therefore, by linear superposition, I arrive at the conclusion that you always never see a definite outcome. But I'd say that argument's kind of cute, but it's a little bit non-conclusive. it depends on your intuitions for what corresponds to a definite state, to having seen something definite. All right. So that's kind of an aside, but here are the two big problems that Everett Many Worlds has to face. One is called the basis problem, and this is basically the question of how do we identify in the unitary evolving wave function what corresponds to these emergent many worlds? And then once you've done that, you have to decide why should we use the Born rule, the quantum probability rule, to assign probabilities to these worlds? And both of these are tricky questions. The first one has a more or less universally agreed solution, which is based on decoherence theory. The second one is still more controversial. Right, so here's the basis problem. So, Everett says, okay, if you write down this state, then relative to spin up, you saw up, and relative to spin down, you saw down, and those are your worlds, fine. But I can write a quantum state in any orthonormal basis I like. I can also write this state in this basis, and I can say relative to spin up in a different direction, in the x direction, you're in this indefinite state, and relative to spin down in that direction, you're in this other indefinite state. So why should it be that this decomposition defines worlds, defines sensible worlds, and this decomposition is not? Because if this decomposition describes the many worlds, then we clearly have a problem. We haven't solved the measurement problem. We haven't explained why you saw a definite outcome. So you can't solve this problem just purely in terms of the states of the system, right? The answer to the question that is generally accepted is that we also have the dynamics. There's also a Hamiltonian. And what we want to do is we want to identify the worlds in many worlds as structures in the quantum state that persist in time, okay? The idea being that, if you have a typical measurement interaction with the environment, this kind of decomposition, these states would persist in time. These are the kind of pointer states that don't get entangled with the environment. But this decomposition would disappear, like change extremely rapidly, right? So it doesn't correspond to a persistent structure. Right. So that's the idea, and we saw, I'm not going to review the whole details of this because a couple of lectures ago I talked about decoherence. The idea is we identify the classical world, rough classical worlds with the pointer states. Okay, the pointer states are determined by the initial state and the Hamiltonian of the system, and we can effectively get a more or less unique decomposition. Now, remember that decoherence is only ever approximate, and the orthogonality of the branches is only ever approximate. So there's always some little bit of freedom in redefining the exact decomposition. So for example, if it's a decomposition into coherent states, those are overcomplete. So there's some slight non-uniqueness in the coefficients, right? Right, so the point I'm trying to make here is that, however, at this stage of the argument, we can't rely on any structures in quantum theory that derive their meaning from the measurement axioms in any kind of way. All we have is unitarily evolving quantum state. So I can't really talk about reduced density operators at this stage. Why? Because the reason I assign reduced density operators to subsystems is because I know that if I make a measurement on the subsystem, that gives me the correct probability rule, right? And no measurement on the environment. And I've derived that by an application of the quantum probability rule, basically. If you had some different probability rule, the reduced state wouldn't be the correct description of a subsystem. So we can't really use that. We have to work entirely with this global state decomposition at this stage. But unfortunately, you can do that in Zurek's approach, right? So in Zurek's approach to decoherence, we assume there's some preferred decomposition of the Hilbert space into subsystems, system and environment, right? That's an additional structure beyond just the pure unitary evolution. But okay, we know what are our subsystems. What's the tensor product structure we're using? And then you can just, with respect to that, define pointer states. Pointer states are defined as those pure states that are persistent in time under the dynamics. Okay? I haven't had to invoke the reduced density operator or anything like that. The Oxford Everettians, for reasons that are a bit opaque to me, generally prefer to use what's called the decoherent historis formalism to define the worlds. I'm not going to go into what that is, but I believe it's a mistake because the decoherent historis formalism uses a lot of things that are derived, in my opinion, from the quantum probability rule. But it doesn't really matter. You use one approach to decoherence or another, and you can define some kind of preferred structure that persists in time. Yeah.
How do you get that preferred structure without using the probability rule?
I'm saying that, okay, so there is, so remember, a pointer state, if I have a pointer state for the system, tensor some state of the environment, under the unitary evolution between the system and environment, this should go to some time of all, okay, so this is at time zero. This is at time zero, should go to an uncorrelated state. So this is basically the definition of pointer state that we had in the decoherence lecture. So I haven't invoked reduced density operators to define what that is. Okay, so it's decomposition into this kind of states. Now, there are technicalities here. I don't think it's entirely straightforward because remember, we can usually only have approximate pointer states. And then you have to say, well, why do I care that this is that the output is epsilon far away from that if I don't have the quantum probability rule? So I think those are genuine issues. It's one of the reasons why Zurek is now moving to this quantum Darwinism approach to decoherence, which is a little bit different from what I described. But I think so. There are still sort of issues to determine, but I think it's possible to define things without recourse to a reduced density operator. Now, the Oxford Everettians, by the way, respond like this, okay? They would say something like this. Okay, you have this unitarily evolving wave function. Anything that's a structure that exists in that wave function is potentially could describe a world, right? If I can identify some structure, some persistent structure in this wave function. So if I can mathematically define something that's a persistent structure, it doesn't matter. I don't have to think about the interpretation of that mathematics. It's there. It's there in the mathematics, right? So even though you're using, you know, products of projection operators and traces of them and things in the decoherent histories approach, and even though we normally think of that as being justified by the Born rule, they would just say, well, look, this is a mathematical structure I can define in this theory. That's fine. So that's also an attitude you can take. But I'm a little bit wary of that because if we haven't yet derived the Born rule, and if it seems like those structures are really justified by the Born rule, or the interpretation of them is usually justified by the Born rule, I'm a little bit nervous of that. And Zurek seems to agree with that kind of position as well. So anyway. So the hard problem is the probability problem at this stage. So now we're dealing with a situation where, okay, we're going to take into account this is why you don't use PowerPoint. Where's something? Do-do-do-do-do. Okay. Here we go. All right. Probably this is going to work. Okay. Okay. So now we're going to incorporate the interaction with the environment, and roughly speaking, when your computer doesn't crash, what are you doing? Oh, I think I should have done this, and I should have done that. Okay. Right. So we're including the environment. So we have a roughly stable pointer basis, and it's going to be the one in which you are seeing a definite outcome. Okay. So let's assume we agree with that. Why is it that you should, before you've done the measurement over here, assign probabilities mod alpha squared and mod beta squared to the two worlds which are going to come up over here? And the even what you mean by probabilities is not clear here, right? Because normally, classically, when we talk about probabilities, we mean that one thing or the other is really going to happen, and we just don't know which, and we're talking about our uncertainty. Here, there's no uncertainty. It's not as if you're either going to become this guy or you're going to become that guy, and you don't know which. There's just one you, and afterwards there's two yous, right? Both of these yous have equal claim to be your successor, right? So an analogy that's often made here, let's make a classical analogy, is imagine that we have a machine that clones people, right? So you're going to go into this machine, two copies of you will be made, right? And then the original version of you will be killed. Sorry, no. And what you have to do is, before you go into this machine, somehow assign a probability to one of those two successors. It's really not clear what to do, right? What does it even mean? Okay, so this is part of the problem. So the part of the problem is to just even define the meaning of probability. And then once we've defined the meaning of probability, we have to explain why they should be mod alpha squared and mod beta squared. So an intuitively appealing thing to do, which a lot of people like to do, is called world counting, right? So the idea is that if after a branching event, there are now n worlds, then you should just count the probability of each world should be like 1 over n. This intuition comes from, I think, what we often do when we're first introduced to probability theory, right? It's like you talk about, okay, a dice has 6 sides, so the probability of landing on one side is 1 over 6, and then we start from there, right? So this would be wrong, of course. So in this case, there's only 2 U's after the branching. So you would say, according to this rule, that the probability of both of them is 1/2, which is not mod alpha squared, mod beta squared. Okay, so this rule is so intuitively appealing to some people that some people just take this to obviously rule out many worlds as being sensible. However, it's really not obvious why you should do world counting. All the worlds exist on an equal footing. It's not like rolling a dice. Yeah, right? It's as I said, it's unclear what probability even means at this point. So why 1 over n is, you know, we don't even have a definition of probability. So why 1 over n at this point? And this objection, also, David Wallace likes to make this objection. I don't think it's a very great objection. But remember that the decoherence is generally only approximate. So these worlds only exist on some coarse-grained, slightly indefinite level. And depending on how you do that coarse-graining, depending on how you set your epsilon when you're going to define your approximate pointer states, the precise number of worlds that you get will be slightly different. So it isn't even a very well-defined number of worlds. The reason why this is not a great objection is that we usually only care about the probabilities in cases when we can really identify the number of worlds, like in a measurement. But nonetheless, it is true in general. All right, so in order to try and solve this problem, we have to get a little bit into the weeds of the foundations of probability, because you may know that interpretation of probability is probably almost as controversial as interpretation of quantum mechanics. But if we're going to say that somehow the interpretation of probability is radically altered by many worlds, then we can't really avoid talking about this. So there's broadly sort of 3 ways that people normally think about interpreting probabilities. There's the frequentist way, which is, for some unknown reasons unknown to me, usually extremely appealing to physicists, but to me it's the least appealing one. So this is the idea that the probability is the long-run relative frequency of an outcome in multiple repetitions of an experiment, okay? So the idea is, if I have a coin and I say the probabilities of heads and tails are half-half, what it means is that if I flip that coin a really large number of times, the relative frequency of heads is roughly one-half, okay? So there are caveats here. Do I mean really an infinitely long sequence, or is there some kind of finite frequentism? There are various types, but that's roughly the idea. There's the Bayesian approach, which locates probabilities basically in the heads, and we will talk about that a bit more. So it says probabilities represent the degrees of belief of a rational agent. They constrain rational decision making. I'm not going to say too much about that right now because I'm going to talk about it a bit more. And the third is objective chance. So probabilities represent some objective facts about the way a single experiment is performed. Okay, so the idea is that in the frequentist approach, you need to talk about at least a very long sequence of outcomes. Objective chance says, no, there's some chance on a single event, some objective property. So we might say that the probability of a coin flip is heads, because the way, particular way you've chosen to flip that coin has a certain disposition to produce heads or tails, right? That might be one way of doing it. But there are various different ideas of what objective chance is. Now, all of these interpretations are controversial. If you ask me to say what's the most common position amongst philosophers of physics, I would say the most common position amongst philosophers of physics is that there's some notion of objective chance, and there's also Bayesian probabilities, and those are two types, and they connect together in various ways. That's the most common position in philosophy of physics. But they're all controversial, and you find people taking various different positions. So if we're going to try and derive probability in many worlds, we should distinguish problems that are basically problems that occur in the foundations of classical probability. I can't rule out Everett on the basis that it has a problem with probability if that's also a problem with classical probability, right? That's not a good reason for doing it. Versus problems that are really specific to the many worlds interpretation. Problems that are specific to the fact that we've changed the meaning, that we now have both outcomes existing. Okay. So let's have a look at an attempt at a frequentist derivation. So this is, Everett originally did this in his first paper on the many worlds theory. This is how he justified probability. So he attempted to do a frequentist derivation. And this has been later refined by other people. People still talk about it sometimes. So what we imagine is that we have multiple systems all prepared in the same quantum state. So let's imagine it's a spin a half particle like this. And after we've measured, we're going to measure each of these systems in the up-down basis. So now, after measuring each of these systems separately, I'll still have a tensor product state like this, but it'll be of a larger system. So here, the environment includes all the measurement device and everything else in the universe that's correlated to the system. Okay, so I'm going to have a big correlated state of larger systems like this. Okay. Now, so to simplify notation, I'm just going to lump these states together, the up states of the system and the environment, as call that the zero state, and I'm going to call this the one state of the joint system. Now what we do is we define relative frequency projectors. So they're just projectors onto basically the relative frequency of outcomes. So here's an example. So for n equals 3, relative frequency of 0, so it's how many spin down outcomes you got, right? So the 0 is everything's in the 0 state. You get a probability of a third of being, well, the relative frequency of a third of being spin down in one of these three states. So we project onto that subspace. Two-thirds corresponds to 2, and 1 corresponds to all of those. So I can clearly do this for any n I like, right? So I can extend this. I'll have more for any, as I increase n, I'll get more and more of these projectors. So what you can show is that if we take the limit n tends to infinity, so we consider an arbitrary large number of these subsystems, and similarly an arbitrarily large number of these projectors for n arbitrarily large, you can show that the relative frequency projector for beta squared, mod beta squared, so remember beta is the coefficient of the spin down component, this is an eigenstate in the limit as n tends to infinity. So the statement is that the state is an eigenstate of the relative frequency mod beta squared projector with eigenvalue 1. And the idea is then to interpret this as saying that the relative frequency of 1s is mod beta squared with certainty. And so if we're identifying relative frequencies with probabilities, then we're done. Okay, so what are the problems with this? First of all, it requires the eigenvalue eigenstate link. Eigenvalue eigenstate link is not part of Everett. It's part of the orthodox interpretation. So it's not obvious that you can just apply it here. But even if you agree with that, when you have an infinite space, an infinitely large space, probability one is no longer the same as certainty, right? All of those sequences which do not have relative frequency mod beta squared still exist in the superposition, just the amplitude gets really small. So it's sort of not obvious why this is justified to do this. And if you're concerned with finite frequentism, if you don't just want infinite frequentism but some kind of finite frequentism, then for any finite n, you'll only get to 1 minus epsilon here, which decreases exponentially. But you can't interpret this thing as the relative frequency is likely to be mod beta squared without first interpreting this as a probability, right? The probability is 1 minus epsilon, which is what you're trying to derive in the first place. Actually, this kind of circularity is present in classical kinds of derivations as well, but it's worse here because, you know, classically you can say things like the probability of the relative frequency is such and such, but here we don't even know that this is interpretable as a probability yet. Okay, so you can make refinements to this. You might say, okay, well, I can probably fix this by defining, for example, approximate relative frequency projectors. So let me consider the relative frequency between is beta plus or minus epsilon and define that projector. And that's kind of what's done in these Graham and Hartle and company works. The mathematics gets a bit more complicated, but you still end up with the same kind of problems. Okay, so most people sort of have abandoned, although this still gets some play, most people have kind of abandoned the frequentist attempt at this point. More popular approach these days is like the decision theoretic approach, based on subjective Bayesian probability and objective chance. So this is Deutsch-Wallis approach. I'm not going to give you the full-blown decision theoretic argument here. I'm going to give you a simplified version that we can cover in the last however many minutes we've got left in this lecture. But you can find a full account. If you really want to know everything about the many worlds interpretation, again, I recommend David Wallace's book. Okay, so first of all, since it's less familiar to people, we first have to understand classical subjective Bayesian probability theory and then see how it applies to many worlds. So just in general, the structure of classical probability theory is like this. So here's an example. Suppose we have I'm only going to worry about finite sets in this case, not infinite measure theoretic probability. So we have some finite set of possibilities that might occur. So for instance, this set might be the possible outcomes of a dice roll. That's called our sample space. A subset is called an event. So a subset of this set represents some proposition we can state about the outcome. So for example, if I tell you that outcome is odd, this corresponds to the subset 1, 3, 5, right? So any proposition, any statement I can make about the outcome corresponds to some subset of that space. Now, the axioms of classical probability theory tell us that probabilities are assigned to these events. The probability of any event has to be between 0 and 1. Actually, these should be greater than equal signs. I don't know why I did that. The empty set, which corresponds to no outcome, nothing at all, has probability 0, because some outcome always occurs. And the probability assigned to the full set, which just means some outcome occurred, is 1. And then the key axiom is this additivity. If I have two disjoint events, right, then their probabilities should add together, right? So if I say what's the probability that the outcome is odd or that it's even, it should be the sum of the probability that it's odd plus the probability it's even, right? That's what that says. Okay, so in subjective Bayesianism, we treat these things as representing the subjective degrees of belief of a decision-making agent, right? A probability means how much, what's your degree of belief that that's going to be the outcome? And then the question is, why should degrees of belief obey these axioms? Okay, so here's one way, not the only way, there are more sophisticated ways, but here's just the simple way to define it. So one way of measuring somebody's degree of belief is to say, what your degree of belief for E is, your probability for E, is the price at which you would be willing to buy or sell any number of the following lottery tickets, right? The lottery ticket is you pay PE dollars for the lottery ticket, and after the experiment, it pays out $1 if E occurs and pays nothing otherwise, okay? So I'm going to say that your probability, I'm going to define your probability to be the price which you consider to be fair for buying or selling this ticket, right? So in other words, this is a little bit of unrealistic, but this is a first pass at this concept. You're going to state what P is, and then I'm going to say, fine, I want you to buy 60 tickets, or I want you to sell 75 tickets. And you have to be willing to do that, whatever I say. So the criterion for rationality here is that you shouldn't enter into a system of bets that causes you to make a loss for every possible outcome. Right? Most of us would argue that if whatever happens, you always make a loss, that's not a rational thing to do. And so from these two things, we can actually derive the axioms of probability like this. Let me give you an example. So, example, let's suppose we violate the axiom that the probability of the event, let's say we set a probability greater than 1, what would go wrong? It means that you would be willing to buy a ticket that pays a dollar if E occurs and pays nothing for a price, nothing otherwise for a price P. Right, so if E occurs, then you've paid this much and you've won that much, but you've still lost more than nothing. Right, and if E doesn't occur, you've lost this much. So regardless of whether E occurs or not, you've lost out. So rationality implies that you shouldn't do this because you'll make a sure loss in either case. Okay, so that was an easy one. Let's do a more complicated one. Let's derive additivity for disjoint events. Now let's suppose that we set PE plus PF greater than P of E or F. What does that mean? It means, okay, so I'm willing to buy these two tickets. So this is the ticket that I'm willing to bet on event E at price PE, and I'm willing to bet on F at price PF. So I'd be willing to buy these two tickets whilst at the same time sell this ticket. You'll sell this ticket, and this ticket costs P of E or F and pays $1 if either E or F occurs. So what's the possible outcome here? Since E and F are disjoint, there's only three possibilities. Either E occurs or F occurs, or neither E nor F occurs. So let's look at what your loss is in each case. So if E occurs, then this is what you paid, right? So you bought these two tickets and you sold that one. If E occurs, then you win $1 from this ticket, but you have to pay out $1 from that ticket because you sold it. So those two cancel, and this is greater than zero, right? Because of that's the assumption. Same thing happens with F for the same reason. And if it's neither E nor F, then there are no payouts, but these two are greater than that. So it's irrational to violate this. And you can actually, by a similar argument, just flipping who's buying and who's selling, do the same thing for the less land sign, and so you'll end up with equality. Okay, so by these type of arguments, you can get the whole structure of probability theory. Okay, so let's try and apply this to many worlds. Now, the good thing here is I can talk about in many worlds whether an agent is willing to make a bet or not. It doesn't really depend on anything to do with the fact that then now there's going to be many worlds. So we'll keep the definition of probabilities in terms of the willingness to make bets on measurement outcomes, right? I can, before you make a measurement, ask you to bet on the outcome, right? And we'll modify our rationality criterion slightly. So what we're going to say now is you shouldn't enter into a system of bets that causes all of your successes to make a loss. Right? This is the analog of in every circumstance. So classically, one or other of the circumstances occurs. Quantum mechanically, in Everett, all of them occur, but still, if they all leave you unhappy, then you would consider that irrational, right? So if you enter into a system of bets which causes you to go into a state like this where you've lost out on both branches, then clearly we should still be able to say that that's an irrational thing to do. So we can now apply the Dutch book to this. We can apply the Dutch book just to the set of outcomes of this measurement, and the sure loss criterion will imply that you have to, the no sure loss criterion will imply that you have to assign a probability distribution to the worlds, right, that obey the usual axioms. Exactly the same argument as classically, because we haven't really changed anything. Okay, so now we've solved part one. We've said, I've given you a meaning for probabilities. This is a meaning for probabilities in terms of willingness to make bets. I have not yet derived that those should be mod alpha squared. Okay, that's the second part. But now we have a meaningful notion of probability. Okay, so let's do the second part. Well, you can't do the second part without some additional assumptions. Okay, and this is where the objective chance part's going to come in. So far, everything's been subjective Bayesian probability theory. So Deutsch and Wallace make some postulates. There are four of them, which really have to do with well, at least this one has to do with objective chance. So if we make these four postulates, then we can derive the whole thing. So this says state supervenience. Supervenience is one of these philosophy words that physicists never use, and it confuses me. But it means everything's determined by the state. I would just say everything's determined by the state. Right, so the probabilities that you should assign, whatever they are, should only depend on the quantum state. Because the quantum state in Everett is the state of the universe. Like, the quantum state is everything, that's all there is. So if they're going to depend on anything, they say, they should depend on the quantum state. And this is what is going to make it some notion of objective chance coming in, because we're saying the probabilities have to depend on sort of the objective state of the universe. Okay, so then these two postulates are really mimicking things that we assume normally in classical decision theory, just in the many worlds context. This is called microstate indifference. And in the present context, this basically means that the only thing that you care about is how much money you have on a branch. If you do a measurement, you end up with however much money because you betted on that branch. If you then take the spin you've measured and flip it, like after you've done the measurement, if you flip the direction of the spin, you don't care about that. You've still got the same amount of money that you have on that branch. That shouldn't affect the probability that you assign to the branch if subsequently you do something to the microstate of the system. And the third one is branching indifference. This says, now this is kind of somehow necessary in Everett, because in Everett, branching events are happening all the time. Every time two subsystems interact and get entangled, you know, and it gets amplified up into the environment, there's a branching event, and these are happening all the time at a really, really fast rate. So this says you don't really care about branching per se. So if you end up on a branch, and then that branch subsequently branches even more, but it doesn't affect how much money you haven't made a bet on that second branching, then you don't care. Then you don't care about that branching event. And then there's this principle, continuity, which is less, I think, obvious why it should be true, but let's just say that the asymptotic probabilities should be a continuous function of the quantum state. Okay, so let's see how we can derive the probabilities from that. So let's first consider the equal amplitude case. So you just have an equal superposition of spin up, spin down. And let's say you make a bet in which you're going to end up with A dollars if spin up occurs and B dollars if spin down occurs. So then this is going to evolve into this. And I've kind of collapsed, you know, there's a mess of environment states and measuring device states and things like that. Imagine that they're all included in, actually, let's imagine that they're all included in these spin components here. Doesn't matter. Now, I could instead have made the opposite bet. So suppose I did the same thing. I made the opposite bet, so I'm going to get a prize at A dollars for spin down and B dollars for spin up. Okay, like that. Now, by microstate indifference, after this experiment is over, you can flip the spin without changing what your initial preferences were. So if when I've reached this situation, I take the microstate of the system and just flip spin up and spin down, then I get to this state. Now, both this bet and this bet followed by the spin flip end me up in the same physical state of the universe. Right, so state supervenience implies that that your preferences basically should be the same in this case and in this case, right? So you have to be indifferent between this bet and that bet. And if you're indifferent between those two bets, then it means that you have to be assigning the same probability to both branches. Because your expected utility, if the probability wasn't a half, your expected utility for one of those bets would be different, would be higher. Okay, so this applies for all possible choices of bets and prizes, so those probabilities have to be a half. And clearly, you can just generalize this argument to any equal superposition of n branches. If you have an equal superposition of n branches, so in that case, we get that the probability has to be 1 over n. So note here, at this point, we've used state supervenience and microstate indifference. That's what we've used. Next, we have to use branching indifference. So let's look at the rational case. Suppose your amplitudes are rational. Then what I can do is I can take this branch. If I do another interaction with the environment on this branch that causes this to split into two branches, then I'll end up with three branches of equal amplitude. And now we're in the case that we've already derived. In that case, we've derived that each branch has to have probability 1/3. But we have branching indifference. So branching indifference says you shouldn't care about the difference between this and this. So this branch has to have the same probability in both of these cases. So because it has probability 1/3 here, has probability 1/3 here, which means the other branch has to have probability 2/3, basically. So from this kind of argument, you're going to get mod alpha squared for rational amplitudes. And then once you've got it for rational amplitudes, you just invoke continuity, which, well, OK, that's maybe less justified, but that's what you do. The argument clear, roughly speaking? Okay, yeah.
So I'm a little confused about why we need to derive these probabilities. So given that in other interpretations you just accept the Born rule, can't you accept an equivalent of that for many worlds?
In which interpretation do you just accept the Born rule, for example?
Like, I thought you introduced this by saying that the main difference for many worlds is you kind of eliminate the measurement.
Yeah.
Can't you just eliminate all of them except for the probability one and then just modify that a bit to apply to branches rather than...
So you certainly can just posit it, but... But then there's a question of whether there's a conflict, right? So in Everett, you're saying, I have a unitarily evolving wave function and that's it, right? And then the question that you have to ask yourself is, suppose I'm an observer living in that branching wave function, what would I experience, right? And why is it that I experience probabilities that are... So you can say, okay, and in addition, it's a bit of a funny thing to do, because first of all, you're not positing the branches as part of the ontology. They're emergent, right? So I first have to derive the branches. So you're saying, start with the fundamental ontology, derive the branching structure, and then at that point, impose another fundamental axiom. That's a little bit of a weird thing to do. But also, you know, it's like, we have to address the question, is there a conflict between imposing that axiom and what an observer living in that universe would actually see? This is kind of like the analog of the measurement problem here, right? It's kind of, we can describe measurements always as unitary interactions from the perspective of the global universe. Does that somehow conflict with positing some probability rule for an observer inside the universe? I don't know if that answers me. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I have a question. It's not that related to the branching.
Yeah.
Branching is not time reversible, right?
I mean, in principle it is, right? Because, you know, unitary evolution is reversible, right? So if decoherence is in principle reversible, but the point is that with the systems with the Hamiltonians that naturally exist in nature, they tend to spread the information further and further out. So in principle, there's a physical interaction which would bring everything back together and recohere everything. But the argument is that it would be physically infeasible to actually do that. Like, you know, because what I'd have to do, you know, in order to sort of recohere the state of this pointer, for instance, I'd have to collect all of the photons that have scattered over it and have dispersed everywhere. I'd have to collect them up, sort of bring them back in without having them interact with anything else, and sort of undo that whole interaction. So in some toy models for decoherence, and in some systems that are sort of almost isolated but not quite, you do actually see revivals and recoherences and stuff like that. So it is a physical effect that exists, but it's just very hard to do.
Okay, then I have a question. If branching is reversible in time, therefore kind of consistent with the Schlenger equation, then how are we using decoherence as equivalent to wave function collapse? Because that's what many worlds do, right? They don't see.
Yeah. So we're assuming that. So the point is that. There is always, I mean, it could always happen that there's a recoherence, right? It could always happen that there's a recoherence.
Okay.
It could, in principle, happen, right? But the idea is that under typical system environment Hamiltonians, when decoherence happens, it basically persists, right? There are some arguments you can make, right? So, for example, if you believe, you happen to be somebody who believes that the Hilbert space of the entire universe is fundamentally finite dimensional. Some people believe that these days. Some approaches to quantum gravity believe that. In a finite dimensional Hilbert space, if you have a Hamiltonian evolution, it's always going to bring you back to the same state eventually, right? It might take a very long time. So if you believe in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, then eventually decoherence has to get reversed. But if we live in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, that's not necessarily the case, right? But at least the claim is that it happens very rarely, or it happens, although the timescales on which it happens are far larger than the age of the universe kind of timescale. So we can effectively imagine that decoherence is pretty much permanent, at least certainly on human timescales, on timescales of the existence of planets and things like this, it's going to persist, right? So effectively, there is no collapse, but effectively, we can work as if there is a collapse. That's the idea. Okay. Well, we're nearly done. Let's just talk about some objections. So here are some objections that have been made. So first of all, the idea of Bayesian probability is supposed to be what should a decision-making agent do in the face of uncertainty? I have some uncertainty. I don't know what's going to happen. The basic premise is to give you a guide to how you should behave. In many worlds, there isn't any uncertainty. All of the successes exist. So the argument here is that you've somehow completely skewed the mission of the meaning of decision theory by doing this. It's not about uncertainty anymore. So there's kind of a couple of responses to this. So Hilary Greaves in particular has argued that we should think of probability as the degree to which you should care about your successes. So think about it instead as a measure of uncertainty, think of it as the degree to which I should care, right? It's a caring measure. This is kind of a weird idea. Why should I care about one of my successes two-thirds more than the other one? Because it has a larger amplitude. That seems a strange idea, but that's one thing you could do. Another thing that some people have done is to try and make it about self-locating uncertainty. So if we apply this argument after you've become, so when you become entangled with the measurement device, there are now two copies of you. So those two copies of you, if they haven't looked at the measurement result yet, don't know which one they are. The idea is that you apply this argument after you've become entangled with the measurement device, but before you are aware of the outcome. And this is says, okay, so now there's some self-locating uncertainty about which branch I'm on. And that's what the uncertainty is about. This is also kind of a weird idea because we often apply the probability rule way before we actually do the measurement, right? So this makes sense that there is some uncertainty at some point. So you have to say, okay, when I say that the probability is one-third now, what I mean is that my future selves will have self-locating uncertainty and the probability there is a third. It's still a bit of a convoluted idea. Okay. The other objection is to, and this is the obvious objection to make if you're a psi epistemicist, because as a psi epistemicist like myself, thinks kind of the whole premise of the state being the ontology is a bit funny. But you could say, well, you know, I just don't believe in the state supervenience because, like, here's an analog of it, and this is an argument due to Adrian Kent. So an analog is to say, okay, we're going to use this kill you and clone machine again, right? So we're going to put you into this cloning machine, create two copies of you, kill the original. The two copies are going to be in two separate rooms. Those rooms are otherwise identical, except for the fact that one of those rooms is going to have the complex number alpha painted on the wall. The other one's going to have the complex number beta painted on the wall. Would you make an argument in that case that you should assign probability mod alpha and mod beta squared to the two clones? Well, it obviously seems like you wouldn't. They're just numbers that are in the sort of numbers on the wall. But in what sense isn't that the case in Everett? Like these, the branches are what you can say classically exists, and they have some numbers attached to them. But those numbers are doing nothing, right? They're just hanging around. They're irrelevant to the future evolution of the system. Doesn't matter what those amplitudes are. So how is this different? And this is kind of like denying that state supervenience rule, because that's where this part of the derivation comes from. So if you're an Everettian, you'd say, well, you know, the only ontology that's available to determine objective chances is the quantum state. So if I'm not going to make this state supervenience the rule, then, you know, what else should I do? And I think that's a pretty decent response to make. My response to that is you should be a psi epistemicist, but that's another question. So all of these debates, so 2007 was like a big anniversary for Everett, 50th anniversary, 100th anniversary, 50th anniversary. 50th anniversary of the Everett interpretation. There was a lot written about it around then. This is a volume from some of the conferences that came around that time where these probability things were debated in great detail. So that's a good book to look at if you want to look at these debates. Okay, so I'm going to end here. I did have another bit on the ironic many worlds interpretation, but I never get to that in this lecture anyway. So, maybe I'll leave the slides in. So Everett's interpretation, it starts from the premise that the quantum state evolving unitarily is the entire ontology of quantum theory. This is the church of the larger Hilbert space writ large, or even throwing out the projective measurements. From this, we derive that there must be many worlds. Most people are satisfied that decoherence solves the basis problem. Probability problem is much more controversial. To the extent that probabilities make sense in many worlds, I believe it's solved by Deutsch-Wallace or related approaches. I personally am a hardcore Bayesian about even classical probabilities. So to me, all these debates about the meaning or whether there needs to be uncertainty aren't that important. We have a well-defined notion that coincides with the classical one in some sense. Even if you believe all this works out, it doesn't mean you have to believe in many worlds. Like some many worlds advocates seem to think, you know, they ask you the question, do you believe in unitary quantum mechanics? Yes. Do you think these arguments work out? Yes. Oh, then you must believe in the many worlds interpretation. No, I can still deny the premise of the many worlds interpretation, in particular psi ontology. I can say I don't believe that this is a literal description of reality. But nonetheless, I don't dislike Everett that much. I mean, I think if you're a Scientologist, this is a decent choice to make. Yes, that is a deliberate joke. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's pretty much it. Maybe I'll leave the ironic many worlds slides in so you can look at them later if you wish.
Can you tell someone in one sentence what ironic many worlds is?
Yeah, it's the psi epistemic many worlds interpretation. So there's a lot more to say about it. But it's like, okay, I want to solve this problem, right? One way of solving this problem is to say, okay, these amplitudes don't exist. If the amplitudes don't exist, there's nothing written on the wall. So the idea is to notice that the pointer basis doesn't depend on the precise values of alpha and beta. These branch the same way, regardless of what alpha and beta is. So the ontology of the theory is to just say, it's not the full quantum state that exists, it's whatever structure determines the branching structure of the wave function. And then you try to build a coherent interpretation on top of that. You try to make an argument for some sort of probability rule. But anyway, I don't want to get into the weeds with that because it's... But anyway, I think you can do it. You can make a psi epistemic many worlds interpretation, and it's ironic because the only real reason for believing in the many worlds interpretation in the first place is if you're a Scientologist, that branching structure is in the wave function. And most psi epistemicists would not like an ontology quite as exotic as multiple worlds. So it kind of satisfies nobody. That's why it's ironic. But nonetheless, we don't have currently a psi epistemic interpretation that's accepted that can explain all of quantum mechanics. So I figure that even having sort of an example, even if it's a really implausible example that it's possible to do this, is a useful thing to do. Right, any other questions?
I believe that Scientologist was
yes.
Coined by Chris Renave.
It was
a Psy student.
It was coined by a Psi student several years ago, but.
You guys are having an impact in the world.
Yeah. Well, I just like the joke, and I write Psiontology. Like I call theorems about the reality of the quantum state Psiontology theorems deliberately. I just like run with it. But anyway. All right, I'll see you tomorrow.